Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
If you're ready for a new job, let Express Employment Professionals help you. Express is already hiring for summer jobs in a variety of industries. Job seekers never pay a fee at Express. Go to expresspros.com to find your location. That's expresspros.com.
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Life comes with big money questions. Is it better to max out your 401k or put more in a brokerage account? Does buying a home make financial sense in today's market? Should you use extra cash to pay off debt or invest? NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast has the answers. Their finance journalists break down investing and budgeting strategies to help you build wealth and navigate major financial decisions. Make smarter money moves. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you listen.
Question for our listeners. Which automaker assembles the most vehicles in the country? Here's a hint. It's the same one that employs the most hourly workers in the country, and the answer is Ford. That's not a coincidence. It's a commitment. A commitment your local Ford stores share. And that is why Ford is now offering employee pricing across their full lineup of vehicles, which means you pay what they pay. So visit your local Ford stores today to take advantage of this great opportunity. Ford Motor Company. From America, for America.
It's the Amazing Rico Bronya Podcast with your host, Evan Roberts.
Rico Bronya, episode number 475. The Mets lose a three-game series to the Arizona Diamondbacks in frustrating fashion. In frustrating fashion. It wasn't your run-of-the-mill. They got outplayed. They got their butt kicked 8-1. It was back-to-back frustrating losses to the Diamondbacks. Back-to-back games in which they lacked that big hit, back-to-back games in which they had to rely very heavily on their bullpen, and back-to-back games where the manager of this team is being questioned by some of his loyal subjects with some of the decisions he made in handling said bullpen. We got a lot to do here on this Rico Bronya. We will pick a Rico star of the series. We'll get into what happened in Game 3, the criticisms facing Carlos Mendoza. And I am going to try to read a lot of your emails. We've received many of them, and so we will go through them and get your opinions on the state of the Mets as they lose this brief homestand and brief series to the Arizona Diamondbacks. Congratulations to the New York Knicks. They have advanced to the Eastern Conference semifinals for the third straight year, and they will take on the Boston Celtics. And let me warn you about this. For those that don't listen to the show I do on WFAN where I've pointed this out, but for the Met fans out there, or for the Yankee fans that are very voyeuristic and like to listen to the Rico, Mets-Yankees Subway Series, the Juan Soto return game, is scheduled to be when Game 6 of Knicks-Celtics takes place at Madison Square Garden. Of course, assuming there's a Game 6. But if the Knicks and Celtics go 6, you are staring at an elimination game at Madison Square Garden versus Mets-Yankees. And not just Mets-Yankees, but obviously the return of Juan Soto to the New York Yankees. Let me start with Juan Soto. Obviously, the Mets have lost back-to-back games. We did a drive home Rico talking about Game 2 of this series. And we did a Rico even talking about Game 1 of this series. So we have broken down both of those games on episode 474 and 473, respectively. But let's give Juan Soto some love. Because this homestand, I know he's had some hard hit balls. I get it. You know, he's hitting some bad luck. We all understand he did draw a big walk, which unfortunately turned into nothing in Game 2 of this series. But Juan Soto was looking for his first home run at Citi Field. And he did it not once, but he did it twice in a low scoring game in which he helped the Mets actually show a pulse before falling short 4-2. He supplied all of the offense. So before anybody rips him and says, oh, now he does it, solo home runs, they were clutch. They were important. The problem was the rest of the offense did nothing. But that was good to see. Because Juan Soto said after the game, when asked about, hey, does that relieve some of the pressure you have? Juan Soto said, I got no pressure. Yeah, I don't have any pressure. And while I like that answer, and I hope that's true, I hope he isn't putting extra pressure on himself, I don't know if it's true. know, there is weight on you of A, making a lot of money, B, making a first impression with not only new fans, but new teammates. And I'm sure just being a human, because I was asking Tiki about this the other day too. Like, you sign with a new team, you have all these incredibly high expectations from the outside world and probably from your teammates too. And your team is winning and you're not contributing as much as the expectations are. You have to think, as a human being, you are going to press a little bit. Juan Soto says no. Juan Soto says there's no pressure, but it was very good to see him hitting two home runs, both the other way, both to left center field. And the hope is, and the expectation is, that as the Mets now begin this road trip in St. Louis and Arizona, Juan Soto can get hot. Because one thing about Juan Soto, we saw it last year with the Yankees. We've seen it in the past in Washington and San Diego. He can carry an offense. There are good players in baseball, but there are very few players that can literally put an offense right on his back. And Juan Soto is capable of it. So despite the rest of this offense doing nothing, despite, again, the Mets having a golden opportunity late in a game, down by a run, second and third, one out. This on the heels of a Soto home run, despite the fact they couldn't get the big hit and they did come up small, there is that positive that maybe Juan Soto is going to wake up. And certainly two home runs is a positive sign. The offense, though, is why they lost these two games. We will spend plenty of time on Carlos Mendoza, I promise. I would say about 90% of the emails on this series is certainly about Carlos Mendoza, and we will break it down. We'll hear from Carlos Mendoza. But let's not lose sight over the fact that the Mets lost 4-2 on a Thursday afternoon in which they could not touch Zach Gallen. They couldn't. We saw the best of Zach Gallen, who I should mention is a free agent at the end of the season. Don't worry, the Mets ain't signing him, because he's on the wrong age of 30 when he gets to free agency. And we know the deal with David Stearns, especially with this pitching lab. Why would you? I think Gallen, by the way, is 29 right now, but I think he will be 30 when he gets to free agency. But his knuckle curve was dancing, and the Mets couldn't do anything. They had two base hits against him. That was it. There was a Pete Alonso single, if memory serves correct, and then one of the home runs that Juan Soto hits. So they didn't have a lot of opportunities against Zach Gallen. But you think back to the eighth inning specifically, because that was really the moment. They're down in the game by a score of 3-1. Juan Soto hits his second home run of the game to make it a little bit closer, make it a 3-2 game. Pete Alonso draws a walk. And how good is Pete Alonso at drawing walks? I know this was a four pitcher, but the guy's drawing 2-3 walks every single game. That's one of the big differences from Pete this year and Pete last year. It's not just the batting average, which is incredibly high. He's finding a way to just draw walks. And then Jesse Winker hits a ball off the bat that I thought was getting out. Now, I'm watching this game on the air, so as I always say, it's a little distracting. But off the bat, I thought for a second, oh, this is getting out. We're getting a Jesse Winker moment right here. And unfortunately, it bounces right in front of the fence for a double. So I had a thought. I want to talk it through. Hoff, you tell me what you would do here. And I had the thought, as Pete Alonso was rounding second base and awkwardly getting to third, and obviously the ball got loose, but once that stop sign is up, there's no way Pete's going to score. And it set up second and third and one out. But as Pete was lumbering around the bases, I did think to myself, would I have pinch run for Pete with Luis Angel Acuña? Because if you do it, here's the positive, here's the negative. Let's just lay it out. The negative is this game goes to the 10th or even in the 9th. You're giving up Pete Alonso's bat, which right now seems nuts considering the way he's hitting. But the positive is you have to tie the game. You're losing this game. And Luis Angel Acuña, not only with his brilliant speed, could have flat out stole second base, which may have even happened earlier in the at-bat. Winker hit the fourth pitch to him. That was the one he ripped for the double. But even if he isn't running, he is scoring from first base. This is a tie game. So I am conflicted. I admit I lean towards not pinch running for Pete Alonso because I'm too deathly afraid of losing his bat. But you're down by a run in the eighth inning. What say you?
Well, here's the first thing. I think that the stolen base would have changed the outcome of the at-bat, first of all, because once you take those players out of, you know, double play, potential double play, Was it, how many outs were there? Was it one or two?
There would be one out. And right, to your point, Ginkle's on the mound, the righty. He could pitch around Winker and go attack Mark Vientos first and second, one out. It's right. Possible.
So I would say that even if they did put Acuña out there, I wouldn't want him stealing the base because I want Winker to hit. I think for whatever reason, I just want to see him get that opportunity. But I don't want to take out Pete right now because who also, if there is an extra inning, who's playing first base? Who's going to move over? Is it Vientos? I mean, I don't know who's taking over first base. And I got to be honest right now, defensively, he's the best first baseman out there on this team. Yeah. I don't want to have that issue. So yeah, you're talking about offensively and defensively.
You're hurting yourself defensively, but I think the attitude is I'm losing a game in the bottom of the eighth inning. And so this is desperation time. This is my moment of I got to find a way to tie the game. Now, to answer your question defensively, we have seen Acuña, at least in the spring training, play third base. So it would have been potentially Acuña goes to third, Vientos goes to first base. It's not ideal. And I admit, I don't even know if I would consider it a first guess because I wasn't thinking about it necessarily when Alonso walked. I was thinking about it as I was watching Pete run, like as he's rounding the bases, because I knew once it didn't get out, he was not scoring. Like, Pete is not fleet of foot. And also, with less than two outs, you're probably not going to take the risk. You're going to say, all right, second and third, one out. Let me give my bats a chance. So it's worth thinking about. I'm just being honest. I wouldn't have pinch run for him. So this is one of those Mendy critiques that I get why he didn't. I think it's one of those spots where it's just it's tough. Like, it's a tough one because you do want to go desperate mode to try to tie the game. But are you really taking Pete Alonso out? And obviously, Mendy decided not to. Here's the headline, though. The headline is there's second and third and one out. And if you're Mark Vientos, who had the atrocious at-bat a night earlier, the one thing you can't have happen, and it did, was not take advantage of two pitches right in the middle of the zone that he fouled off to start the at-bat. He gets a fastball right there. He fouls it off. He gets a slider right there. He fouls it off. He works the count 2-2, fouls another one off, and then finally, a slider low and away, he goes out and he chases. In a situation where hit the ball to the outfield, you don't need to hit a three-run home run. You need to tie the freaking game. And it was so important to tie the game because it was going to affect how Mendy was going to manage the ninth inning, as we later saw. But it's not just Mark Vientos not coming through with second and third and nobody out. It's also Brandon Nimmo, who on a 3-2 pitch got a sinker that was right down the middle, and he just stared at it. So I know you hate when he swings at the first pitch. Well, good news. He didn't swing at the first pitch, took a borderline strike, and then took a sinker right down the middle on 3-2. And just a golden opportunity, one of the rare opportunities the Mets had in this game, was completely blown. And that leads us to the first guess of Carlos Mendoza. We touched a little bit on his bullpen decisions from game two, which we will circle back to. But his bullpen decisions in game three also leave a lot to be desired. Let's start with Kodai Senga. Kodai Senga was frustrating. That's how I would define him. He only gave up one run. He got bailed out by Brandon Nimmo going as far back in left field as he could. And then leaping, wouldn't have been a home run, but he leapt to the sky to take away what could have been an extra base hit. So, yeah, he only gave up one run, but he put nine guys on base. And so Kodai Senga was struggling in this game. And unfortunately, you know, I don't know if there's just a big difference between 4 and 5 to me, or if it's the fact that they were coming off a game in which they had just inserted the extra bulk guy in Brandon Waddell. But I need more than 4 innings out of Kodai Senga. When I get 5 innings, one run, like the Mets seem to get a lot of, you can almost say, ah, it's fine. That's like the new age quality start. But there's something about 4 innings that leaves you saying, I'm sorry, I can't call this a good start. I know you went out and only allowed one run, and you made the big pitch when you needed to. But Kodai Senga labored. It was a laborious outing from him. He threw a ton of pitches. And so I completely get why Mendy took him out. I got no issues with that. It was more, that's not enough, Kodai. You need to give us more. I get you have a 1.38 ERA. That is awesome. And I get it was another example of a Mets starter not giving up basically any runs, in this case only one. But 4 innings is not enough. Hennessy's Cabrera was shaky. He faces three batters, two of them lefties. They both get on base. Max Kranich was mostly good outside of the home run he gave up. And then we get to the eighth inning of a close game. In the eighth inning of a 3-1 game, Carlos Mendoza goes to Reed Garrett. And my head is confusing. My head is confused because I want to play you a clip of Carlos Mendoza prior to the game. Okay. So for whatever reason, after the game on Wednesday, when I did a drive home, Rico, and most Met fans were out there tweeting angrily about Mendy's managing. Obviously, I made my case that it did not make sense that he asked Chris Devensky to pitch a second inning, that it's a close game. I got my big bats coming up. Go to Edwin Diaz. And if you don't want to go to Edwin Diaz, okay, go to Reed Garrett. Go to one of your better relievers to keep the game close. Here is Mendy before the game, before game three, kind of the reporter, I forget who it was, it may have been Anthony DeComo, saying, hey, let's circle back on this because we didn't bother to ask you on Wednesday night. So let's go back and ask you before the game Thursday. Why not use one of your high leverage relievers, specifically Edwin Diaz, in a game in which you're only down by one run? And here, and I love Mendy because he's very honest, here's Mendy's answer for why he didn't use one of his high-end relievers, specifically Edwin Diaz, in game two, down by a run.
This is, I don't know, July, August. It's an easier decision, you know, but when you got seven more to go and you're playing, what, 26 in 27 days, shooting one of your high leverage reliever in that situation, down one, like, it's not an easy decision, you know. We got him up, ready to go in case we would have tied it or take the lead. But down one there, you know, chasing, he was going to be Devensky, you know. And again, it's not an easy decision knowing, you know, you're looking at the offense, what's coming up. But maybe day off tomorrow, today, or the next day, no brainer there, you know. Mm-hmm. But again, playing the long game here, and sometimes you have to take your chances, and it didn't work yesterday.
So he's playing the long game. Down by a run, it's not worth it. Yet, in the finale of this series, down by two runs, not by one run, in the eighth inning, he goes to Reed Garrett. Well, what am I missing here? Because you just said, hey, you know, high leverage reliever. And I know he's specifically talking about Diaz, but Reed Garrett was the other option that you could have used in game two of this series. And you're chasing a lead. Now, you have three less outs on Wednesday night than you do Thursday. But on Thursday, you're down by two runs. And the other thing that made no sense to me, because I get it, you're in the midst of a stretch in which you're playing every day. All right, you get a scoreless inning out of Reed Garrett. Great. I'm not against going to Reed Garrett in the eighth inning of a 3-1 game. I wanted to use him the night before in a 2-1 game. But then you're asking him to pitch the ninth inning, which pretty much eliminates him from being available on Friday. And you just told me you play in the long game. If you just go to Diaz in the ninth inning after you got a run, so now you're down by a run again, you probably still have Reed Garrett available to pitch on Friday because he only pitched one inning. And again, you're using one of your top relievers, who, by the way, you haven't used in 4 days. So he's very fresh. And you don't even know if you're going to need him on Friday or Saturday. I don't like that thinking. I don't like the explanation for Wednesday. And then on Thursday, basically saying, oh, I'll use that reliever I had a chance to use the night before. And I'm going to use him for another inning. I don't like it. I like Mendy's honesty. I just disagree with him. I fundamentally disagree with him. I think Wednesday's decision is worse than Thursday's decision. Because at least on Thursday, you're asking your best reliever or one of your best relievers in Reed Garrett to pitch a second inning. And while that may negatively affect you on Friday, you're giving yourself the best chance to keep the game close. Unfortunately, and this happens, even your better players don't always come through. And Reed Garrett gave up the home run to Tim Tawa. But that one didn't bother me as much as the night before when you're allowing a guy who's literally going to be sent down after the game. That's how much faith you have in him. He's going to be sent down after the game. This is not Chris Devensky from his Houston days. You're allowing him in a one-run game to just come out and pitch the ninth inning in the name of saving your bullpen, who, by the way, the two guys hadn't pitched in days. The two guys in question, Diaz and Garrett, were both fully rested. So you're projecting what may need be needed on Thursday and may need be needed on Friday. Meanwhile, there's rain in the forecast in St. Louis. Who knows when they're going to play? And who knows if you're even going to need those players? You could lose 11-1. You could win a game 11-1. You figure that out the next day, unless the guy's overworked. But Diaz and Garrett aren't overworked. I just did not understand the consistency. I don't like the thinking. And the reason I didn't want to lead off the podcast with it is because I'll make it clear again. It's not why the Mets lost. It contributed to the Mets losing, sure. But they lost because they didn't hit. They lost because they scored two runs on two solo home runs by Juan Soto in game three of this series. They lost because other than a Mark Vientos home run, they did nothing offensively until the ninth inning in game two of this series. And then in that inning, they lacked a big hit. And they went 0 for 10 with runners in scoring position on Tuesday. Or Wednesday. So that's why they lost. It is the offense. It is the fact they're not getting those big clutch hits. But the management of this bullpen is wildly inconsistent. I didn't like it from Mendy. I'm glad that the beat writers wanted to go back to it and say, hey, let's talk about this. It did not make sense. Also, Ty Adcock, I never want to see him again. Ty Adcock, who pitched on this team last year, is another one of those guys, and probably Hennessy's Cabrera too. The only reason Hennessy's Cabrera could potentially stick around is because he throws with his left hand. And right now, the Mets are ravaged when it comes to their left-handed bullpen. Obviously, A.J. Minter last week. Danny Young this week may need Tommy John surgery. So they don't exactly have lefties growing up or growing out of this bullpen right now. A couple of other things. And I do want to get into this Rico Star of the series because this will be fun. And we're going to pound through emails because I want to get everyone's opinions on everything we would.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
It's no surprise that facial hair is personal. It grows from your face. That's why Dollar Shave Club makes the razors, but you make the rules. Whether you're going smooth shaven or maintaining a beard, Dollar Shave Club offers shave and grooming products that are always high quality, but never overpriced. Dollar Shave Club products are now available everywhere. Or visit their site right now for 20% off $20 or more and get your products delivered right to your door. Visit dollarshaveclub.com/shaveup and use promo code SHAVEUP for 20% off $20 or more. And remember, whatever you shave, welcome to the club.
Hate doing cardio? Try brushing and flossing your teeth. I'm not talking about building up a sweat. I'm talking about building a healthier mouth for a healthier heart, for a healthier you. Smile Generation. Trusted dentists look at your care through the lens of the mouth-body connection, because what happens in the mouth plays a critical role for the rest of your body. To find a dentist near you, committed to treating all of you, visit smilegeneration.com/confidence today and live longer, healthier, and happier with Confidence Unleashed.
Going up. Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
Hey everyone, summer is just around the corner and May's packed with reasons to celebrate. Whether you're firing up the grill for a backyard barbecue, soaking up the sun by the pool, or enjoying a long weekend with friends and family, Whole Foods Market makes it easy to kick off the season with great everyday prices on high quality favorites, from fresh produce to grilling essentials. Let's dive into the savings and get your summer fun started right. Personally, I love how easy Whole Foods Market makes it to pull together a last-minute gathering. I was there recently picking up a few things for a cookout, and those yellow low-price signs are no joke. I grabbed their No Antibiotics Ever Ground Turkey and a few 365 by Whole Foods Market Organic Salad Kits. Honestly, so convenient and surprisingly affordable. The quality is still everything you'd expect, but I definitely felt like I was scoring a deal, which I love. Plus those yellow sale signs, I make a beeline for them now. Especially when I saw strawberries on sale, we went through two cartons in one day. Save on May celebrations with great everyday prices at Whole Foods Market.
John Bacon, the home plate umpire, how he misses the strikeout on Eugenio Suarez in the ninth inning right before he ended up popping up is beyond me. And thankfully, Suarez did pop up because he foul tips the ball into Luis Torrens's glove. Torrens immediately says, what are we doing here? It's strike three. The ball tipped off of his bat and into my glove. Gary Cohen is having a coronary, and there's nothing you can do about it because we have instant replay, which is great, but we can't replay everything, and we can't replay that. And I don't know why the umpiring is as atrocious as it is. This crew that we witnessed over the last 3 days in the Met Diamondback series was abysmal. Thank God for replay. I mean, replay saved their asses how many times? Unfortunately, replay couldn't save the John Bacon missed strikeout. All right, let's get to the Rico star of the series. I think we're going to start to have fights about this now because, in my opinion, and I'm just one guy, winning matters. So Juan Soto hit two home runs in the finale of this series, and that's great, and thank you, Juan, for that. But outside of that, did Juan Soto do enough in this series to be considered as the Rico star of the series? Is two solo home runs in a game in which they lost, I'm getting my scorebook out because I want to analyze what he did in the first two games. I know he did nothing but draw a walk. Is that enough to make you the Rico star of the series? He was 0-for-4 in game two with a walk. In game one, he was 0-for-3 with a walk. So we're going to go 0-for-7 in the first two games of the series and then two solo home runs in the finale and say that's your Rico star of the series? I can't do it. Now, I just mentioned them, so if you want to count that as honorable mention, fine. And I'm not knocking Juan. I'm glad he hit the two home runs. It's fantastic. And yes, he's hitting a bad luck. I'm not worried about Juan Soto. I'm not crapping on Juan Soto. But this Rico Star of the Series Award is a very prestigious honor. And we're starting to figure out as this season goes on and you've got series losses like this, how do we determine the true Rico Star of the Series? The Rico I'm the Man Now Star of the Series. So, Hav, you tell me, but I got two candidates. I got two people that come to mind. But before I tell you my two, is there anyone that comes to mind to you for the Rico I'm the Man Right Now Star of the Series?
So, I do want to say that Juan Soto at least started May off right. We talked about, like, he literally, I asked this question last week to BT and Sal. I'm like, do you think that Juan Soto will hit a home run before this month ends? And they both were like, yeah, of course he is. And he didn't. He went April home runless at Citi Field. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, yeah. But May, he hits two. So I feel good about that. I give him at least an honorable mention that he started in that off right. Tyrone Taylor comes to mind because he had a big home run. His defensive plays were unbelievable. I know sometimes it didn't make a difference what he does because if the team loses, it doesn't make a difference, even if he makes a hell of a catch. But I think his play in center field is showing he needs to play every day. He needs to be out there every day. It's making me feel like it's McNeil or Nimmo in left field. Acuna plays second base, but Tyrone Taylor's got to be your center fielder. I don't care. And his offense in the first two games of the series was good enough to make me feel like he is definitely one of the stars of the series.
He is definitely a candidate, 100%. He's one of the two guys that I think we have to consider. So go back to game one, the opener of this series. Not only does he make what you could argue is the play of the year. It actually annoyed me that on the same night Tyrone Taylor made this incredible diving play, America is so pumped up about Dalton Varsho screwing up and then recovering and making a catch, and somehow that's better. It's like, come on. Tyrone Taylor made a catch that in 98% of the world is a triple or a double. Dalton Varsho caught an easy play. He just made it difficult. So why are we giving him credit? So it actually annoyed me. But yes, Tyrone Taylor's defense, especially in game one of this series. Game one was the defensive game. The Mets made so many incredible plays. But yes, that highlight reel catch in the fourth inning against Luis Escorial, catch of the year candidate. He drives in the first run of that game with an RBI double. He drives in another run with an RBI single. He goes 2-for-4 in the opener with the diving catch. In game two of this series, he gets 3 more base hits. He has another one, including the home run that started the rally in the ninth inning that unfortunately came up short. But he had a stolen base. He had an infield hit. He had another clean single. So he backed up his game one 2-for-4 RBI double with a 3-for-4 and a home run performance. Game three was a nothing, and most guys were, other than Juan Soto, took an 0-for-4. So he went a combined 5-for-12 with a home run and 2 RBIs and played great defense. But there's somebody else. And I got to tell you, I'm leaning towards the somebody else. I know that I may need to get slapped in the face. This may be biases, but I think Pete Alonso is the other great candidate. And let me sell you on it, because you're making a face, Pete. I don't think you understand what Pete did in this series. Pete Alonso came to the batter's box 13 times. Okay? Walked up to the batter's box 13 times. He got on base 9 times. 9 of 13 times Pete Alonso was on base. He went 2-for-3 in the opener, hit that bomb of a home run, absolute piss missile, as Jared Carrabas likes to call them, in the fourth inning of that game. But he also went 2-for-3, and he drew a walk. So he was on base 3 times in the opener. In game two, he only made 1 out. He drew 3 walks and got hit by a pitch, including the hit batsman that almost set up the game-winning rally. I thought for a second Pete was set up to hit a game-winning walk-off home run. Unfortunately, he took a 2-2 pitch from Ryan Thompson off of his hand. Turned out to not be a big deal because he played the next day. But 0-for-1, 3 walks, and a hit batsman. And then in the finale of this series, gets on base 2 more times. 1-for-3, clean single, and a walk. So he goes 3-for-7, hits a home run, drives in a run, draws 5 walks, gets hit by pitch, on base 9 times in 13 plate appearances. And we talk about Tyrone Taylor's defense. We have to talk about Pete Alonso's defense and some of the incredible plays he made, especially early in the game. He made an incredible diving play against Corbin Carroll in the first inning, which I talked 2 episodes ago about. That was a clutch play. First inning, that's first and third, nobody out. That game looks completely different. So try to tell me I'm wrong here. It's close. I think I give the edge to Pete, though.
All right, so here's a couple things. I will say he was like a human beanbag at the plate, it felt like. I mean, he was getting hit. I mean, he's been getting hit a lot, which was the one on the elbow not too long ago. That was a couple days. That was the previous series. I feel like he's been getting hit more and more. That's getting aggravating. But it is nice to see that he's still healthy. But we talk about, Ev, we went through every single home run last year, and so far we could say that his home runs have been meaningful for the most part. This one was no one gives a shit.
7-0.
I'm sorry. Yeah, come on. So and for that part, listen, 9 times on base is impressive. I will say that is fantastic. But I can't go above and beyond and be like, well, he was the difference maker in game one when they won.
And Tyrone Taylor was. He drove in the first run. I give you that. And the home run that could have started the rally in game two. Yeah, it's close. All right. You know what, Pete? I respect you. And I also know what will be said if I pick Pete Alonso for his 4th Rico Star of the Series Award. Oh, you're just circle jerking him. And you know what? This may be the only time Tyrone Taylor gets this nod. So, ladies and gentlemen, it is official. For the first time in 2025, hey, Tyrone Taylor, you're the man right now. You're the Rico Star of the Series. Yeah, I felt good.
What nobody knows, what nobody knows is that in front, what you're looking at, what you're staring at right now, is a big white wall with a huge Pete Alonso poster, which is why, and a big like circle and hearts and stuff like that, which is why all Evan ever thinks of is Pete Alonso. So I get it. I understand. I understand why you want to go to him every single week.
Well, I mean, he's been great. He's been great. Like, I mean, I'm not forcing it. You know, I didn't realize until I looked it up, because I needed to remind myself how many times he got on base in this series. Like, that is kind of crazy to get on base 9 times in this series. That's basically double the amount of times Tyrone Taylor got on base. It's double the amount of times Juan Soto got on base. It's an enormous number. And Pete's approach at the plate is just so different. He's a different baseball player. He just truly is. It's incredible to watch. And I hope he's going to have many more Rico Star of the series, but I think he made this one close. Sometimes we've done this like a few weeks ago and it's like, it's Francisco Lindor. Don't even bother. But I think in this case, it was very close to me between Taylor and Alonso.
So you know what I really like about Pete Alonso? And I know now we're making this about Pete Alonso, not Tyrone Taylor. When he walks, especially in a full count, like the other day he walked and got to that full count. They threw that nasty off-speed pitch slot sweeper outside and he didn't bite and he walked. And he like makes like a yell grunting sound towards the bench. Like he is feeling it right now. I love that. I really do love that. And he's still batting, what, 342 if I'm correct?
Yeah.
So I got to ask you a question because I brought up the BT and obviously – he's a Yankee homer. But Aaron Judge batting 427 right now. Pete Alonso's batting 342. I mean, that's both are astronomical for the players that they are. Who's more likely to finish closer to what their batting average is currently at the end of the season? I think it's Pete Alonso.
Neither.
I'm not saying Pete Alonso's batting 342, but it's more like it's to me the drop is not going to be as significant. Aaron Judge is not going to bat 420. He's probably going to bat 320.
Well, Aaron Judge is on another planet right now. Do you think Pete Alonso hits 300, which sounds crazy to think about, considering we're not that far removed from him being a 218 hitter? Like, can Pete Alonso hit 300 this season? Which is a lost art in baseball. Like, a lot of guys don't hit 300 anymore. So forget about 330 or 340. Can he hit 300 this season?
I think he can.
That's incredible.
I think he can because his approach is so different. The way he's seeing the ball is so different. I think last year he just was guessing a lot, and he was just going to, okay, hopefully this is the pitch that I got to see, so I'm just going to swing at it, and it's outside.
One of the most incredible things about Pete Alonso, and I think this is a good number to look at, is walk percentage and even strikeout percentage. So in Pete Alonso, I'll just use last year. I think last year is a decent indicator. Pete Alonso walked 10% of the time, which is right around his career average, 10% of the time. The MLB average is 8.5% of the time. So he walks a little bit more than the average Major League Baseball player. Last year, he struck out 24% of the time, which was a little bit higher than his career average. This season, it's a very small sample size. He is striking out 14% of the time, which is insanely low. Not only is it far and away lower than he's ever had, it's lower than the MLB average. The MLB average is 22% of the time. He's striking out 14% of the time. But the number that jumps out at you is that walk percentage. So I told you it's about 10% in his career. He's walking 16.8%. Those two metrics are completely out of whack right now, in a good way. He is walking at an insane pace. He is not striking out nearly as much. He's going the other way. His approach is different. He is just a completely different hitter. Now, can he go from being a guy who last year hit 240 and the year before that 217 and hit 300? I don't know, man. I'd love to see it. I actually still bet against it, if you ask me. I think he's setting himself up to have a high batting average season, maybe the highest of his career. The highest he's ever had, by the way, is 271 back in 2022, which is a very respectable number. I think he is certainly on pace to destroy that number, but But I don't know if I'm going to say 300. That's
so. So when Barry Bonds hit the year after he hit 73 home runs, he was batting that year he hit 73 home runs. I think his batting average was like around 320, maybe a little bit lower, around that. The following year, he batted 370.
And his and he got on base 58% of the time. It was insane.
Right. And he walked. I think he didn't walk 200 times, but he was close to it. He walked a ton of times.
Yeah.
But it was like there are these jumps in 50 points is a huge jump. Like there's no joke about that.
Yeah.
So is it possible Pete Alonso has an exquisite season? He batted 240 last year. 244 was it? I think the final ball.
If I had to guess right now on May 1st, May 2nd, whenever you're listening to the Rico, I'm going to go 289 would be my guess. And that's a good year. So that's don't take that as some kind of negative, but I know that's 40 points lower than what it is right now. I just don't think he's going to sustain this. I think he will slump at some point. But if I had to guess right now, that'd be my guess, 289. What's your guess?
I think he's hitting three. Yeah, I think he's hitting three. I think he's going, I'll go 301.
301. Let's get to some of your emails, thericob@gmail.com. And yes, Tyrone Taylor, you're the Rico star.
It's time for MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run, the official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Host a local event and give kids in your community a chance to compete in the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 MLB World Series. Sign up for free at pitchhitrun.com.
Series. This is a big one from Benji. Benji's got a lot of issues with Carlos Mendoza. Evan, Pete, obviously the theme of the last 2 days is the lack of the big hit. I'm not excusing 0 for 12 with runners in scoring position and 20 men left on base. Mark Vientos, Starling Marte, Brandon Nimmo, and Francisco Alvarez need to be much better. But I want to focus on the manager because I think the runners in scoring position issue will sort themselves out. It's a fluky stat. Managing, on the other hand, is controllable. It may not always work, but the process should be sound. This was a clown show by Mendy all the way around. So much so, I've compiled a laundry list of missteps in order. Let's go through all the missteps, and I'll tell you where I agree with you. Game one on Wednesday. Well, I think he means game two on Wednesday, because that was game two of the series. Egregious sins. Starting Starling Marte versus Corbin Burns. That is egregious sin number one. So I'll start with that and tell you why I disagree with you, Benji, with all due respect. So the day before, I know it's against the lefty, I get it. Marte hit a home run against Eduardo Rodriguez. And I mentioned this a few Ricos ago. It has got to be incredibly difficult for a player who's been an everyday player his entire career to go out, have a productive day, and then sit for 5 days. I don't think that's the best way to get the most out of Starling Marte. And if you look at the schedule, not just the remainder of that Arizona series, which is now concluded, but the St. Louis series, they're not facing any lefties. They're not scheduled to. So if you play this as, well, I only want him to face lefties, he's never going to play. He's going to have to face righties. And I think that on a day in which he's coming off of a quality day, hits a home run, draws a walk, productive player. I think he's got good career numbers against Corbin Burns. I'd have to double check it. I have no issue with him playing. I really don't. So egregious sin number one, Benji, I reject. That's just me, though. Number two, Chris Devinsky in a one-run game with a fully rested Reed Garrett. I don't know if it was egregious to go to Chris Devinsky in the eighth inning. I think it was egregious to keep him in the ninth inning. And that is number three on his list. Chris Devinsky again for a second inning in a one-run game with a fully rested Reed Garrett and Edwin Diaz. I think with Devinsky up and you are dealing with a bullpen day, so you got a lot out of Brandon Waddell, Ryan Stanek obviously crapped the bed. I didn't mind trying to steal three outs from Devinsky, but that's it. Like once I get those three outs and he kept me in the game, now I go to a high leverage guy. So disagree on two, completely with you on three. I thought that one was egregious.
Could I just say something and add something to it too? Did you hear Davinsky's day? He started
travel
out
wise.
Yeah, he started out in whatever system he's in. He started out at a different location, got the note that he had to come to the stadium. So he didn't even get there on time. Mm. To me, the fact that you got an inning out of him was highly impressive.
Get him out.
Call it a day.
Yeah.
Call it a day.
Yeah, I'm okay with trying to steal an inning out of him. I think that's the reason he's there. He was only going to be there for a day. I think it was obvious. It's a bullpen day. Let's try to soak up an inning, but in a close game, once he gives you the clean eighth inning, you can't bring him out for a ninth inning. Egregious issue number four from Benji. Pinch hitting Jesse Winker for Starling Marte against Shelby Miller. This one is the right decision, but given that he started Starling Marte, how does it make sense to then use Winker? It's still a righty. Again, it goes back to my initial point. I don't think Marte should fully be treated as someone who cannot start against a righty. I think you got to pick your days, pick your moments. And I thought coming off a game in which he hit a home run, it actually was a pretty good moment. Number five, pinch running for Pete as the winning run of the ninth inning rather than pinch running for Soto as the tying run. You got to tie the game first. Also, he only pinch ran once Pete got the second rather than right away when he walked. What's the logic there? What is the logic of waiting until he gets to second base? It's a good question. That's a fair point. They went to Jose Azokar to pinch run for Pete Alonso. And at that point, I guess the thought also is, unlike game three, where it's still only the eighth inning, you're making that change in the ninth inning. There's less of a chance that he may get another plate appearance. All right, I'm with you on some of these, Benji. Here are the ones he deemed questionable, taking Waddell out for the immortal Ryan Stanek. See, I had a problem with that. You know, you're getting a quality performance out of Brandon Waddell. He strikes out Naylor to start the seventh inning. Why am I in a rush to take him out? Number two, pinch hitting Nimmo for Acuna made Nimmo play the field when clearly not 100%. Missed fly ball next half inning for insurance run. Would rather he lead off and pinch hit for Tyrone. Again, I understand Tyrone homered, but it's process, not results. You know where I'll flip with you on that? Acuna was 0 for 3. Not that I want to get nuts about that because he has been very productive lately. And if, God forbid, he gets on base, he's got the speed. He's the one guy who really has the speed to wreak havoc on the base paths. You've got guys on this team that can steal bases, but no one like Luis Angel Acuna. I thought when he pinch hit Marte with Winker that if Nimmo was available, why not go to Brandon Nimmo? That's the kind of the second guess I had or first guess I had concerning pinch hitting. All right, that's only game one. Let's do game two. Or he means that was game two. Let's do game three. It's a three-game series. Number one, taking out Senga. I get that he labored, but if we're going to do the stupidity of a six-man rotation, and especially because we do it strictly for Senga, he needs to be pushed another inning. 85 pitches. Let's see what you have, especially considering Hennessy's Cabrera didn't learn from Wednesday's mistake in bringing in minor leaguers in one-run games. Instantly, he gives up a run, fully on Mendoza, and to make matters worse, he goes to Kranick anyway. Just go to Kranick in the first place. Right decision. Contradictory logic again here. Says before the game, he can't be chasing games and use our good relievers when losing, yet brings in Reed Garrett down by two and didn't go to him down one on Wednesday, brain dead. So that last part, I agree with you. We addressed that earlier. I disagree about Senga. I think he was done. Think about the last batter he faced. It was a ball hit to the warning track, and Brandon Nimmo made a leaping catch. It was over for Kodai Senga. Threw a lot of pitches, was laboring the entire time. I'm disappointed. That's why I mentioned it at the top. I don't love that outing, but you got to put the right guys out there. He was done. Bottom of the eighth inning. Got a pinch run for Alonso. That Winker double easily scores Acuna. Pete likely doesn't get another at-bat anyway. The man has no clue how to use pinch runners, clearly. We talked about that earlier. I'm conflicted about that. You're right. It would have tied the game, but I am deathly scared. I call this the Bobby Valentine syndrome. When Bobby used to take Piazza out, whether it was as a pinch runner or for defense, it would scare the crap out of me. All right, good stuff, Benji. I don't agree with all of it, but I do appreciate it. I appreciate the questions.
What was on game one for him, or game two in reality, on Wednesday? Did he made the defensive replacement with Nimmo? Did he make a point of that too, or no?
The defensive replacement with Brandon Nimmo?
Yeah, well,
That once he pinch hits for Acuna, and now you're moving McNeil to second, and Nimmo's in left field. Yeah, you weaken your defense, or in theory, you weaken your defense. Yeah.
Well, what was the first thing that happened? They hit a fly ball to left field, and it went over Nimmo's head.
Yeah.
I feel like it was like the most obvious situation. He's laboring. He's someone that, yeah, I mean, he had a. I don't know if it was the food or something like that. But
you're not thinking about, in fairness, in the eighth inning of this game, down 2-1, you're thinking about offense. Like you know that you may be weakening your defense, but you're six outs away from losing, or in this case, you're four outs away from losing. So to me, it's all about the pinch hitter. It's about who gives me the best chance. And so I did think, even though Winker just missed a home run, he hit the ball very deep to left center field in that game, I thought Nimmo was the guy to pinch hit for Marte. And if that's the case, Nimmo's not coming in to play defense because he's just going to be the DH. He's replacing Starling Marte. So,
well, that's what I would have done. I think that he's laboring out there, and it's almost like I trust McNeil almost more on left field than Nimmo at this point in time. He made that great catch the wall today versus Senga, but still something about him. He's not as fluid as he normally is. He looks stiff. He looks a little bit, and he's always awkward out there anyway. But it's a little extra awkward these days, so I prefer not seeing Nimmo on the defensive end at the moment.
Paul from Astoria's got a little Mets rant. He says the Mets have done so well over the past 30 games, beyond expectations, but I'm here to complain. So here's my rant. Number one, Tyler Adcock. No thanks, I've had enough. I totally understand giving these bullpen guys a chance. They have to flex their stuff at some point. But why then? Why with two outs in the top of the ninth and your team trailing by two? Garrett gave up the home run, not ideal, but was otherwise pitching well. That was not the time to give a guy his first outing of the season. We all know you only need one out, was ringing in his head with every pitch. Not a great look for Mendy on that one. Ty Adcock is not long for this world. In fact, by the time the Mets play another baseball game, Friday night against the Cardinals, he's probably not going to be in this world. Vientos and Alvarez, adolescent Mets having growing pains. Vientos looks like he's getting back in his head. The at-bat in the eighth was another case of the moment being bigger than the man, and was just another notch in his dreadful average with runners in scoring position. I know he can and probably will do better, but right now the expectation for him in those big moments seems to be that he won't even pull a productive out. He's struggling. Absolutely. Alvarez just got started, but his wild swings are making a comeback. His home run in that 2-0 game against the Nationals looked like a wild swing that just so happened to hit pay dirt. It's still early, so I'm not completely worried, but that last out of yesterday's game, game two of this series, when he stranded a small village on the bases, does not inspire confidence. Both of those games were winnable. The losses are certainly not only on Alvarez and Vientos, but each of them had a chance to be the guy that grabbed the win. Each of them fell short. Thank you for reading. The thing about Vientos, especially with the moment was too big for him, this is a guy who had a game-tying home run in game two of the divisional series in Philadelphia. Like, I can never assume that the moment is too big for him. Sean writes, really annoyed with the Mets' decision-making from Mendoza, as well as the hitting coaches and their strategy for the offense at the plate. The team has blown or thrown away four of their last seven games due to bad decisions, making a bad offensive approaches at the plate. The excuse we get, it's a long season, it's early, when the reality is the Diamondbacks missed the playoffs by one game last season, and this year will probably be within 1-3 games of them at the end of the season. Really frustrating losses when a couple of extra hits this season or better decisions results in us having like three or four less losses. They all count. We saw that last year with Arizona. It's not as much the decisions as much as they annoy me. It's the big hit. And if you have to define the Mets through the 32 games they've played, despite an incredible win-loss record, I mean, 21-10 is excellent. That's been the biggest bugaboo. The biggest issue is that they have just not consistently gotten the big hit. That has been the most frustrating thing about the start of this season. Let's go to Ashley. Ashley writes, hi, Evan. First time emailer. Love the pod. Started listening about a year ago. Now I'm hooked. We appreciate that. I wanted to get your opinion on the second game against Arizona. I was very impressed with what I saw with Waddell. After that performance, do you think he deserves another opportunity up here? I was also surprised Mendy brought in Stanek in a 1-0 game after his two prior blown saves. I was hoping he'd bring in either Kranick or Garrett. Curious what you think. I think Brandon Waddell has absolutely earned another opportunity. Mendy was asked, could he be a lefty out of the bullpen? He is a left-handed reliever. I'm sorry, not a left-handed reliever, but he's a left-handed arm. And Mendy said they're going to keep him stretched out. So he's going to remain in that group of depth guys. So the six-man rotation thing, they haven't really used the six-man rotation. What they're doing is around these days where they want to get Senga an extra day, they're throwing a bullpen game. That's what they've done twice now. Waskar Brazoban starts. He does a good job. He's done a good job in both scenarios. Two scoreless the other night, an inning and a third scoreless the first time they did this. And then it's a random bulk call-up who eats a bunch of innings. Does this change with Paul Blackburn's imminent return? And I say imminent because he's going to throw a rehab game in Brooklyn. So he's on his way coming back. And honestly, you don't even need to stretch him out that much. Because if you're going to use the same strategy, all you really need is 3-4 innings. That's basically what they've done when they use Justin Hagenman and Brandon Waddell. But to answer your question, yeah, I think Waddell could be back here. I think it depends on need. I think it depends on injuries and when guys get healthy, because in theory, Sean Manaea comes back, it's a regular six-man rotation. Frankie Montas comes back, it's a regular six-man rotation. And yeah, they could do the same thing with Paul Blackburn upon his return. So the Mets are going to St. Louis. Let me check that St. Louis forecast, because I heard it was bad. But let's pull up the Weather Channel app right here on the Rico and see what the deal is with this weekend in St. Louis. I don't have to worry about a Knicks game 7 anymore because they took care of business. I was thinking of going to that game. So they're going to play. I just looked at the forecast. Friday, cloudy 66. Saturday, chance of rain 59. Sunday, cloudy 65. They're going to play. They're going Clay Holmes on Friday. They're going Tyler McGill on Saturday. And then Mendy on his own brought up, hey, we're going to insert another bullpen-ish starter on Sunday against St. Louis when they don't have to. As we pointed out, they didn't have to do anything until the middle of the Arizona series if they wanted to remain with Senga getting an extra day. Canning and Peterson could have been up a day. Clearly, there are two things I'm speculating because Mendy never said specifically why. Number one, they probably would rather use that bullpenning game against the Cardinals than the Diamondbacks. We just saw how dangerous Arizona can be, and they're without Ketel Marte. They're a damn good offense. They score a lot of runs. So it could be as simple as we'd rather insert a starter against the Cardinals than Arizona. And number two, maybe they just want to give extra rest to Griffin Canning and David Peterson. You know, we say it's about Kodai Senga, and it mostly is, but they probably wouldn't mind giving an extra day rest to Peterson and Canning. So the way things line up right now is Holmes on Friday, McGill on Saturday, something on Sunday, whether it's giving a kid like Tidwell or Sproat an opportunity. I'll have to check the last time they've pitched to see if that's even a possibility, whether it's going back to a Hagenman or a Waddell and saying, hey, we're going to do the same strategy of we'll start Waskar Brazoban, we'll try to get 3-4 innings out of you and go from there. That's the plan for Sunday. And then the series against Arizona will feature a couple of rematches, or at least they'll face a couple of guys they just faced. Griffin Cannon, Corbin Burns, David Peterson, Zach Gallen, and then Kodai Senga, Merrill Kelly in the Wednesday afternoon game. That's what they have coming up for these six games against the Cardinals and Diamondbacks. I have a question that was sent to us from, oh man, I forgot to write his name down. Sometimes I copy and paste emails. You know what? I got to get this guy's name because it was such a creative question. An annoying question, but a creative question. And all right, here it is. Daniel. Daniel, you got me here. I got to read this. This is about the golden batter rule. Remember the golden batter rule, or the golden rule, whatever the hell they were calling it? The Fugazi idea of sending anybody you want up in a big spot. So Daniel writes, guys, the inability to hit with runners in scoring position in this Arizona series made me think of that terrible rule they've been discussing about a golden batter and how in moments like this, it might actually benefit the Mets, even though I'd hate the rule. In that ninth inning of game two, when they had the bases loaded again because their best hitters again got on base, who would you actually put up there? I feel like even though Juan Soto is the best answer on paper, it's not the best answer right now. But I also don't know if he would be better to pick Pete Alonso or Francisco Lindor. Yes, Pete's been hot lately, but sometimes I just feel like there's more confidence coming from Lindor to make good contact and get the hit. What do you guys think? So remember the golden rule idea? What he's saying is, hey, if the golden rule existed, bases loaded, nobody out, or bases loaded, two outs, could have waited, Alvarez is due up, and you could send anybody on the Mets up in that situation, who would it be? And I read this email, and it made me think another reason why the golden rule idea is the worst idea in the history of the world. How do you make that decision? Like, you'll lose a locker room with that decision. I mean, if Carlos Mendoza says, you know what, Pete, you're the man, I'm going to send Pete up, and you're Juan Soto, and you think you're the greatest hitter in the world, you're going to be like, excuse me? You're Francisco Lindor. You're going to be like, excuse me? You're Pete Alonso, and he picks Soto. You're going to say, what the hell's going on? I'm hitting 340. So it's another it's another caveat to the golden batter rule. Sometimes we talk about this stuff during the offseason and you forget about it. So I appreciate him bringing it up in the context of this series saying, hey, what would you have done? Well, I'll answer it. I think my answer at this point right now, it's about the moment. And in the moment, the guy you want at the plate is Pete Alonso. He's drawing walks at a Soto-like pace. He's been clutch all year. That's the answer. But luckily, we will never, ever, 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 ever have to actually answer that dopey question.
Well, unless Savannah Bananas take over the MLB and decide to like implement their rules, then otherwise the golden batter is on. I looked into the Blade Tidwell and Brandon Sproat. So Sproat pitched yesterday, the 30th. When was this? What game are they looking
for? This will be Sunday, so he's out. Brandon Sproat, not an option.
And Tidwell's pitching tomorrow.
Tidwell, out, not an option.
So those two guys, see ya.
And Blackburn, has Blackburn started his rehab game yet? Has that occurred?
Oh, that I don't know.
He was scheduled to do it over the weekend, so I don't think he's an option either, to be honest with you. So it's probably going to be very – it could be Waddell again. Look, Waddell only threw 60 pitches. Actually, it can't be Waddell because they sent him down. And so you've got that rule where you can't recall a guy within 10 days. So it actually won't be Brandon Waddell. It could be Justin Hagemann. They could bring him back. It's so funny with some of these guys that come up. They come up, they pitch well, and then you see what they're doing in the minor leagues, and they're terrible. And it's like, what are they doing at the major league level that they're good here, and then when they're back in the minor leagues, they pitch to 5 ERAs.
Blackburn, by the way, is supposed to pitch tomorrow.
Yeah, so he's not an option either. I would assume Blackburn is an option in the next couple of weeks. Now, the Mets have multiple off days coming up, so the Mets could get creative. They play these three in St. Louis. They play the three in Arizona. Then they have an off day on Thursday, May 8th. Then they play three at City against the Cubbies, three at home against the Pirates. So six straight days. So you're going to need to add that starter. You can work around the off days, but you can't really do that with Kodai Senga. Actually, you can. So the way it's scheduled is that Senga is going to pitch Wednesday, May 7th in Arizona. That's his next start. So it'll be on full rest. They have an off day. They could then go Holmes, McGill, Canning, Peterson, Senga, and then Holmes again. And then there's an off day, and then the Subway Series against the Yankees. So they actually could avoid having another sixth starter until they get to that Yankee Red Sox area, because they actually have a road trip in which they go to the Bronx and they go to Boston. So with these off days coming up, they can manipulate it to where it could just be Paul Blackburn, especially with him scheduled, as you said, Hoff, to make that start over the weekend. So we'll keep an eye on what they decide to do Sunday, but three-game series against St. Louis, three in Arizona. The Mets are sort of struggling right now, having lost two in a row, three out of five, four out of seven. That is why I look at the way they're playing right now. I look at St. Louis. I look at Arizona, 3-3. I would sign right now for a 500, 3-3 road trip. That gets them back to Citi Field at 24-14, taking on the Cubs and the Pirates. Especially, you've got the uncertainty on Sunday. We know how tough the Diamondbacks can be. I would sign right now for 3-3 on this upcoming road trip. 3 in St. Louis, 3 in Arizona. What say you? You can email us to ricob@gmail.com. ricob@gmail.com. I'll tell you, it's fun being at Citi Field. The place is electric. And when you head out to Citi Field, you can knock one out of the park and raise the apple with Takara Shuhai, a sparkling cocktail that blends real shochu spirits with the delicious flavors of fruits locally grown in Japan. It's available at Citi Field in Fuji Apple, of course, white peach, and lemon. To our Ricoers out there, we appreciate you listening and downloading and subscribing. We will always have a Rico Bronya after every series is over, and we'll mix some in after games. So that's why you should subscribe, because you never know when Hoff and I are like, screw it. Let's react to that Met Cardinal game. Let's react to this game. So be prepared, because we're always ready to Rico. Thank you very much for listening, subscribing, and downloading another edition of Rico Bronya.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Rico Bronya podcast. It's amazing, isn't it? Make sure you download it now to keep it on you at all times.
Podcasting isn't just evolving. It's having a full-blown identity crisis. I'm Allison Marino, host of What's a Podcast? The Revolution Redefined. A new series that pulls back the curtain on the forces shaping the medium now and what that means for all of us who love podcasts. I'm really excited to share the official trailer where you'll hear from some of the biggest names in the space. Ira Glass, Leo Laporte, Guy Raz, Hernan Lopez, Lex Fridman, AJ Feliciano, Dan Granger, and yeah, me too. Here it is now.
I still want to kill the word podcast.
That's not just a hot take. It's a symptom of an identity crisis.
Big company run media, and people are trusting it less and less. It's really important that we're independent.
There's a handful of companies that control the vast majority of podcast inventory that have the vast majority of the gigantic shows.
We left radio behind for a reason. We wanted to get away from all the gatekeepers.
I don't know that you could do this as effectively in video.
Podcasting is at a crossroads. I've watched the industry swing from hype to consolidation to reinvention. But this time it's different. From the producers of the documentary Age of Audio, Oxford Road presents the Media Roundtable special series. What's a podcast? The Revolution Redefined.
All of us who work in the media, like, yeah, we got to run a business and like, we got to make a living and we got to sell our ads and we got to do all that. But we all got into it because like, I think most of us, like, it just gave us a feeling.
A three-part series where you'll hear the leading industry voices give their takes on what podcasting has become and where it's headed next. Teaming up with Oxford Road and Age of Audio director Sean Colon for this series was fun, but also kind of a wake-up call. If you love this medium as much as I do, you've got to listen to What's a Podcast? The Revolution Redefined. It's out now, wherever you get your podcasts.